we did last time and discuss a little bit more about the topology. And I think this will be the last we do on anomalies. We'll do something other beyond the standard model stuff next week. So the massless QCD Lagrangian is given by summing over the number of flavors of Q bar A left, I D slash Q A left, and then likewise for the right-handed. So that's SU3 color, and these are the SU3 gauge covariant derivatives. So this thing has a global SUN left cross SUN right symmetry. As we've mentioned before, I can do a global transformation on the definition of the left-handed flavors, and the right-handed don't get affected, and vice versa. So I can say what you call up, down, and strange, or whatever, is not what I would call up, down, and strange, but they're related by this and the left and this and the right. So strong interactions are expected to form condensates. In fact, the whole notion of a quark mass is complicated because of this notion of a condensate, that the gluons so powerfully bind the quarks together that in their bound states, quarks effectively behave as though they have mass, even though maybe they really don't have mass in the original Lagrangian. So these condensates in general will be these kinds of vacuum expectation values that can be denoted as UAB of X, or maybe I should put one up and one down for that, but UAUB of X. And this I can write, excuse me, as the exponential of some other matrix where the field in here is denoted as psi. So this will be some collection of vacuum expectation values that live in the flavor space. And this breaks the symmetry in the vacuum state. This breaks to SUN vector in the vacuum state. So under, let's call this, I don't want to keep writing that, so I'll call this a global. Let's call this G flavor. So under the G flavor symmetry, this condensate U will go to B left U times B right, where B left and B right are, I don't know why I called them B, but I did. B left and B right are unitary matrices under that. There's a number of flavors here. I keep suppressing that, but sorry, yeah.
So the Q's within the brackets, it's a left and a right?
Yeah. So yeah, it would be, sorry?
So yeah, just kind of, the Q's inside the bracket, do they have left and right?
One would be a left, and the other could be a right. Yeah. So if I transform, I can transform this whole thing by BU B inverse. So there are n squared minus 1 psi fields. And what they do, the idea is their dynamics are the dynamics of the condensate. Condensate dynamics. They describe the dynamics of the condensate, and their action will be given by this thing that got introduced before. There'll be a constant f pi squared d for x times the trace of d mu of this thing and d mu of e to the minus that thing. So the idea is these condensate dynamics are described by this action, which has this a global GF symmetry. It still has this global flavor symmetry because this thing here gets a B left, B right, and this gets a B right inverse, B left, and so the trace cancels those things out. Maybe I should put a dagger here, I suppose, to be more formal. So, sorry, yes. In the vacuum. I mean, it's so at low energies, because you're coupling left and right, the vacuum doesn't retain the entire symmetry of the state. But so if you like, these low energy states themselves are this U matrix, and I can redefine what I mean by condensates like so. But I can make, so I have a redefinition of the, just the way I have a redefinition of the quark flavors like so, I have a redefinition of what these condensates mean, because a condensate transforms with a right-handed and a left-handed matrix where one is this and the other is that. And yeah.
So initially we had nf squared degrees of freedom.
Have what? Sorry?
Initially, we had nf squared degrees of freedom.
Yeah.
And
nf, you mean in the matrices, as opposed to the number of quarks. There are nf left quarks and nf right quarks.
Right. So, that's the number of fields we have, right?
Yeah.
So, and the condensates are just only n squared minus
1. Yes. So there, sorry, because I could have any, I could have any, the trace actually turns out to be irrelevant, but yeah, I got NF of these, I've got, so you're talking about this, yeah, I've got NF of these and NF of those, and I can combine them any way I like. So I can have a U bar D, I can have an S bar U, I can have all of those things.
So what happens with trace?
What happens with the trace? The trace turns out not to have any dynamical significance when you put it in. I think you can describe, the trace, you can include it, but you can also eliminate it from the theory, basically, by subtracting out. It's an overall scalar in the space. So if you want it, you can have it, but you're not required to have it. So I suppose, strictly speaking, it could be included. Somebody, yeah?
I'm just having trouble seeing how we can have these bound states, because our original theory had left and right decoupled quarks. So like, how do these interactions?
Well, they happen via the gluons. So the theory is there is some they're exchanging gluons, and the idea is it's such a powerful, analogous to the way that nuclei and electrons exchange photons, sticking them together. The gluons do this by some not fully understood mechanism. I mean, gluon exchange is not enough. This is the problem of quark confinement. So what people did phenomenologically is say, okay, we don't exactly know the details of how quarks are confined, but they appear to be confined. So what are all the possible condensates we could make out of a quark-antiquark pair? So if you like, these are all the possible meson states you could make out of n distinct flavors in left and right sectors. And then you leave. So the idea was, let's not worry about how this works. Let's just say that it works. And what would be a good Lagrangian for describing these quark-antiquark bound states? That's the philosophy behind this. I probably should have said that earlier. To the best of my knowledge, I would say, strictly speaking, quark confinement is still an unsolved problem. We have hints that it ought to work, but I don't know of anything that actually definitively proved this. There was a lot of effort given to it, and then it sort of, people decided to do other things. But and let lattice gauge people, I guess, would be the people technically working on that. So the issue, what I wanted to do on this is just mention where the anomaly comes into this thing. So this is not everything. It still needs the anomaly. And the reason is that if you did a path integral over the E, the action associated with that L, and worked out what the effective action was of the gauge fields, you would find that it would have this kind of structure that I mentioned last time, that XA acting on this effective action would equal GA acting on the gauge fields. And if this is not the variation of some local functional, then we have an anomaly. Because if it were, you can show, if this were an equality, you can basically show that this can be reabsorbed into that using counter terms. But if it's not equal to a variation, then you cannot do that.
I'm a little confused where that action is.
Sorry?
Where is the action?
It's hypothesized as the action that, where'd it go? It's hypothesized to be the action that associated with these condensates that obeys the criteria that you have the smallest number of derivatives so that you've got the proper low energy physics, and that it respects its invariant when you do this to it. So that's why you need the trace. You've got a B right dagger, B left dagger, and the trace cycles it out. So this was a hypothesis. This is the proposed low energy effective action for the condensates. It's not something that is, how shall I say it? It's not something that was mathematically derived from the original action in a direct sense. Rather, it came from the expectation that the interactions of what goes on here generate this via some physics we don't entirely understand, but we'll say, once we've got this, what is the right way to describe the physics of this structure here? And so they say, well, the simplest thing we can write down is that this is just the derivative of the if you look at the definition, this is just the derivative of the condensate times the derivative of the dagger of the condensate. That's all it is. So the idea is the condensate, this is the kinetic energy of the condensate.
Is it obvious that there's no interaction?
So how do these condensates interact with each other? Well, to leading order, we're not going to put in interactions till we understand the leading order. So you could do that. But one of the interactions that had to happen come from this. Then you might imagine you want to put others into the theory. But it turned out this was remarkably, forgetting about the anomaly, this was remarkably effective for describing kaons, pions, eta mesons, rho mesons, all of these different mesons and their varying decays were very well described by this simple thing. But there were a few things that did not work. One was pi into two photons, which was why they needed this. So that's where that came from. It's not a renormalizable Lagrangian. But that doesn't matter because the idea is it's a low energy effective Lagrangian. So when you go to high energies, the condensate dissolves and the actual thing you should use is the thing in the upper left board. And that is a renormalizable Lagrangian. So the argument is you have some effective low-energy non-renormalizable Lagrangian that describes the behavior of the bound states, and if you went to very high energies and had to take account of loops, the bound states would all just dissolve or evaporate. They would disappear, and then you would get the original massless Lagrangian. So I want to get on to some of these index theorem ideas about anomalies. So I just only want to say a little bit more about this. So the question is, how do you include an anomaly in the context of this effective action? So the idea is to construct, so let me put this, how to include anomaly, include the anomaly in S of Xi. And the answer is to solve this equation that I will define in a minute for Z, or for W, sorry. And what is W? And what is Z? Well, Z is defined to be the variation of this with respect to some gauge parameter times delta xi b, just the way the x's, oops, maybe I should write down what the x's were. I put them up yesterday, but I shouldn't expect you to remember that here. The x's are defined as d mu delta a mu. So these generate functional variations of the gauge fields. So the idea is to extend this effective action to the gauge fields and the condensates. And so this acts on the gauge fields, and this Z acts on the condensates, where Xi prime E to the Xi prime, let's just look at the left-handed sector, is B left, e to the xi, and that's e to the little u, e to the xi. So this little u is that little u. So the idea was to construct some generalization of gamma, we'll call it w, that includes an effective action of the gauge fields and of the xi's, and this is going to bring in the interactions you were worrying about or wondered about, at least in part. So the solution to this equation, so the solution to that is what we call the Wessimino action, or sometimes this is called the Wessimino term, and it's given by the integral of e to the minus t. Maybe I'll write it as exp, so I have a bit more room. The exp of minus t, the integral of d4y of xi x. So these are operators that are acting on the integral of d4x times ua of x, ga of a of x. Yes, so this whole thing should be on one line. And so the effective action for both of these things becomes the original action plus this Wessimino action here. So the idea is from this, you can figure out what the anomaly is, and then you shove that answer into here and then act on that answer with this operator here, and that generates W. And you can show that W, basically, this is the formal solution to this equation where I've chosen this quantity U to equal that. I suppose I've suppressed a line of arithmetic here. Let's see. I'll just write down the formal solution is equal to the exponential of d4y, let's say, of u times x plus z, acting on some w of xi a. So in other words, you solve it like you'd solve an initial value problem. Suppose you knew w for some fixed xi and a. Then the solution to this equation for any other xi prime and a prime is given by exponentiating that operator there, where these would depend on these things like so. So this one follows from that. If I take the parameter here to be minus the xi's, and it's not obvious perhaps how that goes. This is actually just follows formally. If you put these definitions in here, you bring down one power of x plus z acting on the w, and you actually solve this this equation. This assumes that w of 0a is taken equal to 0, or 0a prime, I guess, is taken equal to 0. So what happens, gosh, I've lost one line. I think I'll rub that out. When you put this in, and I'm showing this as an application, I'm not giving the steps, but when you put this in from the non-abelian anomaly, you find that the W term gives 1 over 6 pi squared f pi squared epsilon mu nu rho sigma times the trace of 5 fields d rho pi d sigma pi, where the pi's are given by xi a t a divided by twice that pion decay constant. So in four dimensions, just so you see what this thing explicitly, put it up higher, explicitly looks like. This is basically xi dot t, derivative of xi dot t, four times, contracted with an epsilon, and that would be added to this here. And then you find that all of the effective actions for pions, kaons, other mesons works, even for the decay of pion going into two photons. So that part of the action effectively generates the term you need to account for what those anomalies did that we looked at earlier this week. Yeah. Pardon me? Oh, I'll write it over here. It's hard to see, sorry. Pi is defined as 1 over twice f pi times this condensate dotted into the gauge field generator. That's all that pi is. It's a common notation. Yeah.
So why did our original Lagrangian, why was that not sufficient to generate an anomaly for pi and decay?
Well, it is. I mean, we did that. If you look at what the pions do, in some sense, that's what we did whenever it was Monday of this week, I think, or Tuesday, I forget. But so it is. But the point is to generate this without worrying about those triangle loops. See, the quarks have all disappeared in this formulation. The mesons are all either pseudo-scalar fields or pseudo-vector fields or something like that. So the idea is, can you describe those interactions without going back down to the quark level? And the answer is, yeah, that term doesn't. That's the point. So you could. In fact, that's what people did. And so that's the connection. Does that make sense?
So is the idea that you're completely erasing the quark kinetic terms and replacing it with the new action?
Basically, yes, that's right. At the condensate level, that's correct. The idea is the quark terms just get wiped out entirely. The mesons have no idea they're made of quarks. They behave according to that effective action with that other term in there. And this works very well, actually, to describe low energy meson physics. In fact, it works better, I think, than people thought it ought to work when they constructed it. So the idea of that was to show you, it was to follow up on what that X gamma stuff does. It's used in generating, it can be used in generating effective actions, and partly, I guess, still is used if you're a person who believes that there is substructure to quarks or leptons or what have you, then similar ideas would be used, that an electron is the condensate of, I don't know what, prions or rishons or something. Those ideas were used there as well. To my knowledge, there is no positive evidence to support these kinds of substructure models, and people don't work on them anymore, or hardly anybody works on them anymore for that reason. And the favored substructure model, if you can call that, would be something like string theory at this point in history. Yeah.
So this is like a bit of black magic.
Pardon me?
Is this like a bit of like a black magic to do at the moment?
I don't know why you use the word, maybe gray magic.
Well,
what do you mean? Magic. I mean.
What I mean is that you're basically you're using the Vesumino formalism to derive the anomaly for an action that is effective action that is.
Yeah. In some sense, yes.
So if we add, say, more terms to the effective action, then this would generate more anomalies.
Well, for the abelian anomaly, it can't. There are theorems that show that you won't affect it. As I said, for the non-abelian anomaly, everybody thinks the same is true, but I don't know that there's a genuine rock-solid proof of that. What happens If you add any other terms, you can add other terms to that thing. But remember, the condensate, there's a dimensionality to the condensates, which is expressed by that f pi squared, right? Q bar q is not a unitless quantity. It has dimensions. That's what the function of the f pi is. So anything else you add, so the argument goes, would be that is a function of the condensates, would be dimensional, and it'll be suppressed by powers of a mass-breaking scale. So you can do it, but unless that mass scale is very low energy, those other terms won't matter very much. But this one does matter, comparable to the other one. This, if you, some sense, compared to that term, this is the most important. And the hypothesis here is simply it's the kinetic energy of the condensates. What's the simplest thing any physical structure can do? Well, it has energy of motion, right? Which is basically what that is, relativistically. So, all right, so what I think I'll spend the rest of the time on, I won't get through all this, is this notion of an index theorem. So just to give you some introduction to some of the mathematics behind this, there was this notion that d star of j5, remember, we saw in the path integral derivation was twice the sum of phi n dagger gamma phi phi n, and that was 0 times infinity, because the phis gave a delta of x, but there was a trace of gamma 5. The phis gave delta of x minus x, and the trace of gamma 5 gave 0. So when it was regulated, it gives us that, where f is equal to a half f mu nu dx mu wedge dx nu. That's what that f means. And upon integrating, what was pointed out a couple of days ago is this is equal to that. I'm tracing over all these are solutions to d slash phi n is lambda n phi n. So I'm tracing all over all the Dirac holology that is in here. But there is a completeness rule. Because of the trace, I could pull this around to the front and use the fact, I guess I'll have to write it down, that the sum. Well, it's implicitly over everything you can trace over, the Dirac indices, the function. Let me just write down what I was going to write down. Phi n of x, phi n, this is delta of x minus y. So because of this trace, I could pull this around to the front and use that. I'll get delta of x minus x, which is the delta of 0, times, you know, if I put in the Dirac indices, this is a, this is b, that's delta ab. Right? So then that's what gives me the trace of just gamma 5 by itself. Does that help? Okay, so what is an index? The index of an operator O is defined as the number of positive chirality or helicity or duality solutions, n of O plus and minus equals number of plus or minus duality solutions to O acting on some field phi equals 0. They're the number of 0 eigenvalue solutions to an equation to the eigenvalue equation for O, where these are defined on some manifold M. A form or some kind of field defined on a manifold M. That's what phi would be. So in this context, phi would be a Dirac field. But you could imagine, in fact, let's give examples. Maybe I'll write it over here. Examples, phi could be given by psi, and then we'll have psi plus or minus is a half, 1 plus or minus gamma 5 acting on psi. I could call this phi plus or minus if I wanted to, or more generally, I don't have to be gamma 5 dimensions. I could be in 2n plus 1. I could be in 2n dimensions. So this is the chirality operator, gamma 2n plus 1, gamma 2n plus 1 acting on psi plus or minus is plus or minus psi plus or minus. So there, the eigenstates of gamma 2n plus 1, gamma 5 in the real world, is tell us whether you've got positive or negative chirality. And we have orthogonality in that psi plus, excuse me, psi plus bar psi minus is psi bar minus psi plus, and that's zero. Psi bar left, psi bar right is zero, and vice versa, yeah.
What does plus or minus duality mean?
Well, I'm going to try and give a more general definition at the moment, but as an example, it would mean this in this context. It would mean, here's another example before I get to the what your thing is. So another example would be the gauge field strength itself. I can write it as F mu nu plus or minus F dual mu nu, where F dual mu nu, remember, I think is a half epsilon mu nu alpha beta F alpha beta. And so I could imagine some operator, I don't know what it is yet, but F plus mu nu times F minus mu nu is equal to zero. It's orthogonal as well. Yeah. What is NO plus minus what? Sorry?
So what are the n's in the previous
example? They are the number of duality, positive or negative duality solutions to this, which means you need a notion of duality on a manifold, which I haven't fully defined, well, which I haven't fully defined yet. So you need the, I've given a couple examples to show you what I mean by this. But what, so they would be the number of solutions, you'd have some operator acting on a field or a form for which duality or chirality can be defined. You have a notion, if you like, of handedness. Here's one example, here's another example.
So what's the operator in this case?
It's something that meaningfully acts on this other something to give you an eigenvalue equation, except we care about the zero eigenvalues. At the moment, I'm being very general. In this case, it would be the Dirac operator. In this case, it could be some other differential operator. So let me, here's another example. So what O needs to be, it needs to be an elliptic operator, which basically means that it's an invertible differential operator at its derivative point, and we need some notion of duality. The manifold must admit a definition of duality or chirality on phi. If it doesn't do that, none of this works. So if you had a manifold that had a field or a form defined on it, and if you could construct using some structure on the manifold, epsilon or gamma 5, that allowed you to define a notion of handedness, then you can make a definition of an index. And it needs to be, what you basically need to do is in each case construct what you mean by this statement and find some operator that's elliptic that meaningfully acts on things of this type.
So in this statement, there is no explicit mention of, the manifold doesn't have to be even dimensional.
It does not, but in these examples, I mean, in principle, you might be able to find such a thing, but to my knowledge, there is no notion of this if the manifold is odd dimensional. But I can't say for sure, it's impossible to do. But all the examples I'm aware of is, so M is typically even dimensional. So what the idea was to generalize the notion of handedness, right-handed, left-handed. We had that for Dirac fields. You've got a notion of duality. I don't know that I am prepared to be any more mathematically rigorous here. I'd rather do this example by example or case by case. Let's see. Characteristic class. So the idea of doing this is people did notice this anomaly, and physics people noticed this anomaly, and then mathematicians began to ask, okay, how do we understand this structure in terms of something topological, because this is a topological invariant. And so they came up with the idea, well, there must be some, in fact, they were thinking about earlier, there's got to be some notion of the number of eigenvalues of differing chiralities, or eigenvectors of differing chiralities that have zero eigenvalues. It's possible to show when the eigenvalue's non-zero, the states all have to be paired. And the only way to get a lack of pairing is at the zero eigenvalue level. So let me go on a little bit to just sketch out these ideas. So suppose we're given, or we have some one form on a manifold M. Then, in general, if I have some manifold, I'll need several patches, right, on which I define the manifold. For example, a sphere, I could have the northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere, or a torus, I could define various pieces of it. So we have these overlap regions here. And in an overlap region, so this is U1, U2, and these U's are the various patches, etc. U3, I don't know how many U's there are. So A of UI would be related to some coordinate transformation between the ith and the jth patch, like so, where they overlap. So the a gauge field, I'll have a well-defined theory if on patch J, if the gauge field on patch I is related to the gauge field on patch J via a gauge transformation that is defined on the overlap. So this is a group element. and the group elements are defined in here. They might be defined elsewhere, but I at least need them to be defined in the pass in the patches. These are transition functions between between the different patches on the manifold. So a characteristic class is a closed form on a manifold constructed from a gauge field strength. So you give me, if I have some gauge field, I can construct its field strength. And if you can give me an object that is closed, then that thing is called a characteristic class. And the integral of that class is sensitive to these transition functions in the sense that I can always solve, closed form, let's call it P. So I have dP equals 0. So locally, by Poincaré's lemma, I can write P as d of, do I have a general notation for it? P as d of q, say, where the q's, of course, will be sensitive to the transition functions. They'll be defined patch by patch. And if I can do this everywhere, then I've got a trivial solution. But if I cannot write this the same way everywhere, in other words, if there's a non-trivial relation between the Qs from patch to patch, then I have an interesting gauge topological structure on the manifold. So the one example we saw already is that P could be the trace of F to the N. dP is in a 2N dimensional manifold. This is a two form, so it'll saturate it. So it has to, because this has as many dx's as there are dimensions, the d of this thing has to be zero. And it is certainly a closed form, but because of the anomaly, it's not necessarily an exact form. It's not necessarily the d of something. So if d omega plus omega squared, then we must have P of G inverse omega G to be P of omega. It's got to be gauge invariant, and P is some polynomial, typically. Or rather, could always be expanded as a polynomial in the gauge potential. If you constructed some other function, because it's a form, I could expand that function for small values of the argument, and eventually the number of dx's will be larger than the manifold, and the power series will truncate, and so you're going to get a polynomial. Yeah.
So, sorry, you said that if the q's are on different patches and non-trivially related.
Yeah.
Then, so what do we get then? What's the consequence of that?
Well, the consequence will be that you will have, it'll be a measure of the topological non-triviality of your manifold.
P.
Yeah, that's right. So, in fact, the integral of P will give a number, and that number is a thumbprint that tells you something about your manifold that you would not learn locally. So locally, you can always do this. The integral of a characteristic class gives you some number whose knowledge tells you something about the manifold's global properties, topological properties, insofar as the gauge field strength at least is concerned.
Is omega meant to be the connection?
Yes, that's right. Omega would be, I called it A over there, but omega is a one form. So omega is omega mu dx mu. It's a one form. And it is a gauge one form. Omega prime is G inverse omega G plus G inverse dG. It transforms like that, which gives you that. And so this put into here gives you that transformation, and we require P to be invariant under this transformation. So the trace of F to the N is an example. Is that... is that okay? So, in fact, one example is that gauge field. Let me give the two most famous examples that are relevant to physics is that omega is equal to A, capital omega equals F, which is the Yang-Mills field strength. But another one is that omega is equal to gamma AB mu dx mu, and capital omega is equal to d gamma plus gamma, and let me put this in, d gamma AB plus gamma AC wedge gamma CB, and that is what we call the gravitational two-form strength. In other words, that's the Riemann tensor written in form language, basically, where omega, gamma is called the spin connection. And, but in general, you could have the curvature, omega can be any Lie algebra valued form. So in general, so that's one thing that you could have. Number two is that dp of omega is zero, which is closed. That's the definition of what we're looking for. And number three is that the integral of p of omega equals a topological invariant over any compact, provided the manifold is compact. Which means it's boundaryless.
Is it two-form in any dimensions or just in four?
It's a two-form, omega would be a two-form in any dimension. There may be, I think people have thought about generalizations going beyond that, but you run in, it's trickier. It's trickier to do. There has been some thought given to that. So, so just to flesh this out a bit more, suppose I define omega t as t times omega 1 minus omega 0 plus that, where t ranges from 0 to 1. So the idea is this is some form, and I interpolate between omega 1 and omega 0, and they are not gauge related. omega 1 does not necessarily equal that. In other words, this is just, I'm imagining in form space interpolating between one form, one kind of one form over here, different kind of one form over there, and we see what happens. Well, omega t will be d omega t plus omega t squared. And one can show, which I'm running out of time, so I won't show, but you can show that d by dt of p of omega t is m times so if p of omega is equal to the symmetrace of omega to the m, say, then this turns out to be d of the symmetrace of omega 1 minus omega 0 times omega t to the m minus 1. And from that, you can show that the integral of p of omega 1 is equal to the integral over the manifold of p of omega 0. You do that by integrating both sides with respect to t. There's a comma there. You do that by integrating both sides of this equation with respect to t. These are all functions of t in here when you put them in. And you can show that you also have to use that dp is equal to 0. So this, it's in this sense that at least this symmetrace is an example of a polynomial that would indeed be closed and topologically invariant, form a topological invariant on the manifold. I guess I'm pretty much out of time. I probably should continue this for a little bit on Monday just to finish it off. But the result of the index theorem, let me just write down the answer, but I think to be fair to you, I'll have to invest a little bit of time in this on Monday. The result of the index theorem is that this is equal to that. So the index of some operator O acting on some field phi that interacts with gauge fields is given by the integral of a characteristic polynomial associated with that operator, truncated at the 2nth term of that polynomial. So you give me some function of omega that is associated with this operator. That's one example for the Dirac operator. If you give me that, I've got some horrible function, but I'll expand it as a series. The 2nth term in the series, in other words, the form in the series that saturates the dimensionality of the manifold, you integrate that, and that turns out to be the index associated with that operator. So I think maybe I was hoping to finish this off today, but there was a bit more time on the effective stuff than I thought there would be. So would you want me to spend the first half hour on Monday finishing this off? Because it's, you know, it's like you don't want to leave you hanging. But we'll get to instantons next week for sure on Monday. So I'll spend the first part finishing off this because I didn't get to it all. Yeah. It means this is this operator is that operator. So in other words, this polynomial will be associated with this operator in a way that I have not had time to flesh out because we're out of time. So that's what I want to do on Monday. in the case of the Dirac operator, I would write P of D slash of F was trace of F to the end, right? So that, in the case of what we've been doing all along, O is the D slash operator, F is the gauge strength, and it turns out this is equal to that. So all that this subscript means is this polynomial has to be meaningfully associated with this operator O. I mean, I can construct other gauge polynomials of the field strength, but they're not necessarily associated with the anomaly.
So that
P is a special case of the P over there. Yeah, it is. It's not any polynomial function. It is a particular polynomial function that is associated with this operator in a way I haven't had time to spell out yet. That's the whole point of extending this to Monday. So how it's associated with it, I'll give some examples of that. But in some sense, the object of the game, looking at it from this viewpoint, is if you give me an operator, an elliptic operator, and a manifold on which I can meaningfully define a left-handed and right-handed field on which that operator acts, that index will be associated with some, the index of that operator will be associated with some particular polynomial that has to be specified according to the properties of the operator. So as I say, I jumped ahead about a page just to show you the bottom line, but I haven't shown you how to get to the bottom line yet. If you gave me another half hour, I'd do it, but we'll do it on Monday, okay?